to get started. Today's open talk, heard of in one of the series, but I think also a little bit of a start. I think the deep part of you, we are double knots, and the interaction between high and low other kind of culture.
Okay, so I have to start with an explanation and an apology. So the explanation is that there was some volcanic eruption in Iceland, and therefore I missed the conference that I was going to go to before coming here. And I worked hard to prepare a talk for that conference, and I really, really, really wanted to give it. And so, but I have to miss it, so I'm going to give it now. And the apology is that it's not quite what I've advertised, and even worse, in order to give it, I had to compress the last two lectures into one, and I think it was visible. So, that's my apology. Before going on to this UMINI lecture, which I did not give, I actually want to say a few more words about the talks of the last 2 days. So first of all, they are already on the website. They're being videotaped as tapes. You must have noticed the tapes are already on the web. You can find them rather easily. I mean, I will not tell you the URL. You can find it yourself. Furthermore, they're even annotated a little bit. And for example, if you click on the timestamp next to the annotation said saying thanks, Ralph Mayer, it will get you directly to the part of the video where Ralph Mayer should be thanked. Okay, so enjoy if you wish. Now, another thing that I didn't say, and I very, very, very briefly want to mention, is that the W invariant, in the case of knots, is fully understood. Okay, so the ZW in the case of knots is fully understood. In the case of links, it is not fully understood. So if you have more than one component, I'm not quite sure what it is. But in the case of single component knots, it's dealt well, oops, I lied. It's almost fully understood. So let me explain. So basically, I have a certain formula, and I will not tell you how to derive it, but basically you take a picture of an ordinary knot. An ordinary knot is in particular a W knot. You label it in a certain way, and for each crossing you define the span of the crossing, which is the arc going between the first time you visit that crossing and the second time you visit that crossing. I guess you first have to pick a base point on the knot. By the way, this knot is the knot 817, and I stole the projection from Brian Sanderson, who himself made it into his backyard garden. Oh. So, but anyway, out of this information, and I will not tell you how, you create a certain matrix. Here is essentially the matrix, but then you have to multiply it by some other factors. You take the determinant of this matrix and call it A, and then I have something truly embarrassing, and I challenge you to resolve, to help me out of my embarrassment, which of course will embarrass me even more. So the embarrassing thing is that this determinant looks very much like many of the known formulas for the Alexander polynomial. However, and furthermore, I've written programs to compute it for all knots with up to, I don't remember, maybe 11 crossings, and it always computes the Alexander polynomial. However, I don't know how to prove that it's the Alexander polynomial, but this is completely a classical topology problem. Right? There is no mention of finite type invariants, expansions, associated gradients, any of that nonsense in it. It's a theorem about determinants, which I don't know how to prove. But the evidence is overwhelmingly strong that it's true. However, I do know how to prove that the invariant C that we computed, that we defined last time, up to some normalization, organization, which I understand, is given by this Alexander, by this A, which presumably is the Alexander polynomial, with some sort of dressing. I mean, some formulas have to be put on the way, in the way, but the point is that Z is the Alexander polynomial modulo an embarrassing gap in my understanding. Okay? So that's second comment, or I don't know, I lost count. One other comment that I wanted to make. And then here is another comment that I should have made last time, but I didn't. So last time I told you about a statement in Knot theory, which is you can find an invariant that satisfies Weidenmeister formula. So you can find a value for the vertex so that the invariant that we get would satisfy the Weidenmeister formula. I skipped telling you that there are two other sort of more minor moves, or moves that appear more minor but are actually harder, and I will not tell you about them now either, but they're on the back side of yesterday's handout. And I did show you that this statement corresponds to some diagrammatic statement, and then I rushed really, really, really quickly to try to convince you that this diagrammatic statement is related to some statement about convolutions on Lie groups and Lie algebras. I should have said it explicitly, and I didn't. That this whole rush from here down to here is only heuristic. The point was to demonstrate that there is a relationship, but the skips were too big. And in fact, if you really wanted to prove that this diagrammatic statement implies the convolution statement, you'd have to take a detour, and the detour goes through, well, an equivalence with the work of Alexeyev Torossian, which in itself is equivalent to the work of Kashiwara and Verne, which and Kashiwara about some statement about 3D algebras, and Kashiwara and Verne prove that this statement implies the convolutions statement. Oh, and I should have said that there is also an equivalence between the Alexeyev Torossian statement and a certain one word statement called true. Okay, so.
What's the picture up here?
Oh, the picture. The picture is not in the handout, right? Maybe I should magnify it just once. The picture is the symbol of truth and beauty. Okay? So it's the logo of the Institute of Advanced Studies. It's sort of, it has the word truth in it. Anyway, the reason I didn't take the detour, even though it's the truth, is because it's just extremely inelegant. It's much less elegant. The statements you see along the way look like that, and they simply, you lose the relationship with Knot theory. Or with beauty, I mean, maybe with truth it holds, but less so with beauty. So, so that's why I skipped it, and I also skipped mentioning that this statement about convolutions has an interpretation in representation theory. It is somehow closely related with the orbit method of representation theory, and I don't want to say more about it. So I think that concludes my apologies about last time, and I now want to what is this? Sorry, I have no idea what that is. What that was, and I hope, and I now want, no, I think it's because I'm still connected to your wireless network and it messes up things, so I just, sorry about that. Okay, so, the other one, so now today's lecture. Okay, so again, my plan for today, which was my plan for last week in Rimini, is to tell you about 18 conjectures, completely computational, completely naive, can be, you know, if a computer can understand them, you can too, that Louis Long, Fintan Rotema, Ivan Latua, and myself if you remember, we've defined invariants of type n, so that's Vn. We've also defined, well, of course, it means that we've also defined invariant of type n minus 1, and we said the strategy is to study invariants day by day. So in other words, I want to look at invariants of type n, modulo invariants of type n minus 1. That's a finite dimensional space, as it turns out. And the statement is that this space is equal, or the dimension of this space is equal, and in fact it's isomorphic, to the dimension of the space of Wn, the space Wn, where Wn is the space of weight systems. So Wn is the dual of An, where An is a certain space of diagrams modulo relations, and we've discussed the diagrams and relations in the W case. In the U case, I actually didn't discuss it, but it's classified. It's been around for, almost 20 years. But the theorem, well, one side of the inequality, one inequality is very easy. The other inequality is surprisingly hard. It's completely wrong to think that this theorem is an easy theorem. Okay? So, it's the so-called fundamental theorem of the theory of finite type invariants. And there are three essentially different proofs that I know of. One is the Concierge integral, which uses the division geometric of connection, which is sort of a piece of differential geometry, but well, you know, it fits in an hour of lecture, but it's definitely, but it's not your first guess. Okay? The second proof uses Chern-Simons theory and perturbation theory and Feynman diagrams and things like that. And again, with effort, it may fit in an hour and a half of lecture, but it's not your first guess. And then the last proof uses associators and the techniques that I, the general direction of techniques that I mentioned before, but associators are hard, and to prove that an associator exists, you need homological algebra. So it's definitely not a naive theorem, not a simple-minded theorem. The computations that Leon, Rukema, Halakiba, and I made suggest that there is a similar theorem in the case of V-naughts. I will state the case of V-naughts in a minute, but first let's stare at this table. So really, when I say V-naughts, it turns out that there are many classes of V-naughts. So you can make choices. First of all, when you're talking about ordinary knots on a round skeleton is the same as ordinary knots on a long line skeleton. In other words, if you have a trefoil, surprise, it's the only one I know how to draw, but that's a knot on a round skeleton, you can always cut it open and turn it into a knot along a long line skeleton, and you can show that the resulting long line skeleton is independent of where you cut open. For V knots, it's no longer true. So, the theory of V knots on a round skeleton is actually genuinely different from the theory of V knots on a long skeleton. Then there is another silly theory that you can study, silly but interesting, it turns out. So, you see, you can essentially look at the orthogonal complement, not orthogonal, but the complement of U-naughts within V-naughts. So you can declare that an overcrossing is the same as an undercrossing. In the theory of U-naughts, that would cancel everything, because every U-naught can be undone by flipping overcrossings to undercrossings. This is not true for V-naughts. So, so in some sense, it's the complement of U-naughts within V-naughts. The complementary space to U-naughts within V-naughts. There has actually been other cases. There is another beautiful example in mathematics where in knot theory, where such an orthogonal complement is taken. So you know, you can look at the orthogonal complement of knots within links. Okay? So what it means is that you declare that over is equal to under if the two strands involved belong to the same component. So if both of these belong to component number I, you declare that these are equal. This, of course, kills knot theory. You're left with a certain theory of links. And it's a beautiful theory of links. It's the theory of Milnor linking numbers. So it's due to Milnor. And, you know, it's the theory which says that the Hopf link is not trivial. And the Borromean rings are non-trivial. Sorry, I'm not going to draw the Borromean rings. And it's, again, a beautiful theory. I guess that was just enough. Anyway, likewise, you can also pick and choose which of the Ryukawska moves you mod out by. Okay? And I'll tell you about these a bit later. The point is that for all of these 18 choices of interpretation for the word V0, in all 18 cases, you can compute Vn mod Vn minus 1, the dimension I mean, and you can compute the dimension of Wn for each specific n. So here it is done for n going from 1 to 5, which is as far as we've done. Okay? And in principle, you get two tables, each table consisting of 18 entries, in each entry, 5 numbers for n going from 1 to 5. Okay? But only one table is displayed here because the two tables are equal. Okay? So these are our 18 conjectures. The 18 conjectures are that if you continue this sequence, it will continue being the same on both tables. And if you continue this sequence, it will continue being the same on both tables and so on. Okay? You know, I'm sorry if it's disappointing, right? The 18 are really the same conjecture, but you see, I'll comment about it later. It's not at all obvious that if this theorem is true, this one is also. There are no implications between these theorems that I know how to prove. Okay?
So the what? Vn's were obtained by this passage to Liefeld algebra with the gradient.
I remind the definitions. I remind all one.
The W is what? I mean, how automatic is this? It seems to be last minute.
No, it's not automatic. Wn is not automatic. Had it been automatic, you'd think maybe there is a general theorem.
So we have to make 80 Wn's.
Yeah, it's kind of uniform but not automatic, and I'll make a comment about why is it not, in what way is it not automatic in a minute.
Okay.
Well, not a minute, a few minutes. Okay? Anyway, so let me remind you, what are virtual knots? So, virtual knots are maybe I'll remind you what a circuit algebra is. So, you have components, you can glue them together whichever way you want, rather than just in the plane. And for virtual knots, the components you start from are crossings. And last time I was not careful about orientation, now I do want to be careful about orientation. So in fact, there are two types of crossing. So there's the overcrossing and the undercrossing. And there is some right-hand rule that tells you how to tell them apart. So, you know, in one type of crossing, if you hold one strand with your right hand, then your fingers point so that your thumb points in the direction of flow, then the fingers point in the direction of the flow of the other strand. And in the negative crossing, your fingers will be pointing opposite to the direction of flow. So there are really two types of crossings. So really, virtual knots are oriented, directed virtual knots are the circuit algebra generated by two generators, modulo relations. And again, now that I'm more careful about the relations, about So there is the Riemann-Stahl-1 relation, and you may or may not impose it. There is the Riemann-Stahl-2 relation written here, but in fact there are two Riemann-Stahl-2 relations. When you undo a certain, what do you call it, overpass, double overpass like this, it may be that the two strands are oriented the same way. So I will call it the braid-like Riemann-Stahl-2, because this could occur in braids. Or it could be that the strands are oriented the opposite way, and the easy way to draw two strands opposite, going the other way, is to make one going one way and the other go the other way. And this is called the cyclic Riemann-Stahl-2 move, because if you look in at the bibone that appears here, well, this is oriented up, this is oriented down, this is cyclic. Okay? So there are two types of Riemann-Stahl-2 moves, the braid-like and the cyclic. However, I have chosen to draw the cyclic move in a funny way. And that's not, it's still the same move, right, up to a Riemann-Stahl, up to a virtual Riemann-Stahl-1, but still I chose to write it in a silly way. Had I not written it in this silly way, things later would be different. It's really funny, but topologically it makes no difference, but this has to do with the question that Thomas asked. If you write things the right way, they become automatic, otherwise not. Okay? But we'll get back to it later. Likewise, there are Riemann-Stahl-3 moves, and this is the braid-like Riemann-Stahl-3 move, because the triangle in the middle is, well, because this could have happened in a braid. All strands are oriented the same way. Now, if you take one of these strands and flip it, the orientation of the triangle in the middle would be oriented, could be given a counterclockwise orientation, and I suppose on the other side it would become clockwise, but anyway it would be cyclic. And I didn't draw the R3C move, and the reason is that one can show that once you impose all other, once you impose R2C, R2B, R3B, and R3C are equivalent. So it's enough that I made the distinction in the Riemann-Stahl-2 side, in the Riemann-Stahl-2 part. So I suppose now the rows of this array make sense. I could just impose the standard relation, so meaning impose everything. Okay? And then with Riemann-Stahl-1, or without Riemann-Stahl-1. Or I could restrict my attention to braid-like Riemann-Stahl moves, and again with Riemann-Stahl-1 or without Riemann-Stahl-1, or I can do something which appears silly and in fact probably is silly, not all 18 conjectures are equally interesting. I could just look at Riemann-Stahl-2 without Riemann-Stahl-3 at all, and again I get yet another class of virtual knots, or yet another family of classes of virtual. Anyway, so now I told you what are the knot theories involved.
Professor Schmerzenkopf asked, is there direct interpretation for this 18, no, okay, 6, 5, 6, by holding this or that kind of relations? I mean, could we have half act more by showing what the fact
is? So, for some of these classes, there is a geometric interpretation. For most of these classes, there isn't. Okay? And the true reason, so I have, well, to schematically explain why I'm interested, I'm actually interested in it in a rather indirect, for a rather indirect reason. I'm interested in this because of its relationship to algebra. And I'm interested in the algebra because that same algebra allows me to also construct invariant of U-knots. So, you know, as a topologist, my interest is rather indirect, and it's maybe... But still, still, I'm describing a sort of simple-minded conjecture. I haven't yet described it, so, you know, the conjecture is that two things that we can compute are equal. I told you about many classes of virtual node, but I didn't tell you yet what these two things are. So one is finite type invariance, meaning you take the ideal generated by a difference like that, meaning a crossing module and non-crossing, and again here I didn't indicate the sign, so really I mean there are two types of things that generate this ideal. The overcrossing minus the nothing and the undercrossing minus the nothing. Okay? You look at this ideal within the circuit algebra defined over here. It makes sense in all cases. And then you look at virtual nodes in one of the classes, modulo the n plus first power of this ideal. And like we said last time, this is the dual of that, so linear functionals are that, on that are functions on virtual nodes that are annihilated on n plus one dimensional cubes of virtual nodes. So these are exactly what we call finite type invariants of type n. So one thing we measure is finite type invariance of type n. The other thing we measure is the diagrammatic space, much like here, which seems to be, but isn't provably, the dual of the associated gradient. So let me explain. So again, the strategy is to study Vn by studying Vn module Vn minus 1. And let's try to understand Vn module Vn minus 1 a tiny bit. So, so here we only study nodes. We only make computations for nodes. One component, single component. But that component, we did it both in the closed case and in the long case. Okay? Anyway, so let me quickly explain Vn module Vn minus 1. So there is a pairing between Vn and I to the n. Right? Because the L, when I say there is a pairing, I mean if you take an element here and an element here, you can pair them together and get a number. Well, obviously there is a pairing. This is simply a set of invariants, right? So it lives inside KU. Okay, it's all elements here are linear functionals or not, or nodes. This lives inside K. Okay? So clearly there is a pairing, there's nothing to say about it. This pairing annihilates, so if you take a type n node, it annihilates I to the n plus 1. That's the definition of a type n node. Sorry, a type n invariant, right. So Vn annihilates I to the n plus 1, so the pairing descends to this quotient. Well, that pairing also annihilates Vn minus 1, because Vn minus 1 are type n minus 1 invariants, which by definition vanish on I to the n. So the pairing, the tautological pairing I wrote before, descends to a pairing between these two things. Tiny bit more, you find that it's that now I've got it out by everything that I could, and it's a duality. So therefore, Vn modulo Vn minus one dual is In modulo In plus one. Okay, and the thing I really want to study is In modulo In plus one. Now, it's very easy to find a generating set for In. Namely, I is generated by over minus nothing and under minus nothing. So an L with a plus sign will mean that you can either cross these two lines with an overcrossing or cross them with a no crossing. Okay, and take the difference. Likewise, there is a definition for an arrow marks that an arrow with a minus sign on it, and I'm sorry for the interference from the mouse pointer. And so if you look at the circuit algebra with these two generators, it maps to, it's a graded circuit algebra, and the degree n piece of it, the degree n piece of this circuit algebra, I guess I should have added here somewhere a subscript n, and I failed to do that. Also, I should have put a comma here between the two generators, and I failed. But anyway, that circuit algebra of diagrams maps into this space, onto this space. It's clearly surjective. Okay?
So you said that with these generators, are there any automatic relations to think of these generators?
At the moment, yes. At the moment, no.
That's about the free one.
Yes. So basically, it's the circuit algebra you can, you can write with these generators. So what would the typical element look like? Well, so, you know, let's first do it stupidly and then think. So stupidly, it's just, you draw a bunch of generators, 1, 2, 3, here is a plus arrow, here is a minus arrow, here is a minus arrow again, and then you connect them in whichever way you want. I suppose it's an oriented circuit algebra. I guess I didn't mention that notion, but you could define an oriented circuit algebra just as you could define an ordinary circuit algebra. In computer science terms, in electronics terms, it has to do with the fact that connectors have female and male versions. That's exactly what orientation means. So, but anyway, so to keep the orientation, I have to do this. And then this connects to here, and this, and then this will connect to here, and so on. But that same picture could have been drawn in this way. And then I restrict my attention to the part in which the skeleton is a single line or a single circle, depending if I'm talking about long knots or round knots. But anyway, the diagrams that I get are diagrams that simply look like this. Arrow diagrams. These are finite for any given n. There is a finite number of these, and it's relatively easy to generate them on a machine. So it's in principle, so this space is very much computable. Okay, as Thomas mentioned, there is a kernel. So when you map this space to here, there is a kernel, and I will call the kernel RND. So the grammatic relation, R for relations, N for the number of arrows, and D diagrams. RND is not the kernel of this map. The kernel of this map is what I want to know. RND, RND is those relations that I know. It might be less than the kernel. Now, what are the relations that I already know? Here is the full list. And again, really the conjecture is that this list is everything. Okay? So, in a minute I will tell you how we derive these relations, but first of all, let's say what the relations are. So, there is a relation which is parallel to the randomizer one loop, and it says that if you have an isolated arrow, so an arrow that doesn't intersect anything else, it's equal to zero. The whole diagram is equal to zero. So, if in this diagram, there was another arrow that doesn't intersect any of the previous one, either here or maybe inside somewhere, then the diagrammatic R1 would say, I set this diagram to zero. says that if you have an error with a plus, it's the negative of an error with a minus. Oh, so over here, I failed to tell you that all arrows should have signs on them. Okay? But R2B just says, once you impose R2B, the signs disappear, because you can take, whenever you see a minus sign, a minus arrow, you can replace it by a plus arrow, and stick a minus sign in front. Okay? R2C is funny, it's a new relation. People for some reason didn't notice it before. Before we did our computations. So I suppose these people. It's this relation. If you have two, well, we like to call it the Roman 12 relation. So if you have XII, then the X is equal to the II. Okay? R3B is perhaps the most fun relation. And it's written over here, okay? So if you have three pieces of the strand of the knot and two arrows connecting them, well, where the first one goes from the first to the second and the second goes from the first to the third, then, well, and then there are five other such diagrams and the sum of three of them is equal to the sum of three others, okay? And again, you should be thinking of these strands as being a part of a long line. So really, if I wanted to write this relation in more detail, but unfortunately it would take more space, it would be a relation of the following form. You have, let's do just one side of the relation. Okay? So, you know, you have a tiny, you take the long interval, you mark three parts of it, part one, part two, part three, and then three more, and then you do the same in all three places, one, two, three, and here one, two, three, and again you need to do it again for the other side of the equation. And then you may have more arrows, so you may have an arrow like that in all three places, okay? But in the parts that are marked, you have arrows not shown. So you have an arrow from the beginning of part one to the beginning of part two, and another arrow from the continuation of part one to the middle of part three. That's one arrow diagram. The second arrow diagram, this one, you have an arrow from part one to part two, and an arrow from part two to part three. So an arrow from here to here and another one from here to here.
The blue stuff is also somehow directed. It's always going up in your...
What?
The blue lines.
Oh, the blue lines should be directed and my orientations are always up.
This is why you have a sphere from left to right.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Sorry. You're discovering all the faults in my handout. I forgot to click on add an arrow. And I forgot that a good number of times. Anyway, so I think, well, I will not continue with the other four terms, but I think it's clear in spirit what the relation says. Okay? Then there is one last relation, which is the relation corresponding to an overcrossing is equal to an undercrossing. This is the orthogonal complement of ordinary knot theory inside V-knot theory, and it amounts to saying that the arrows are anti-symmetric. If you flip the direction of an arrow, you flip signs. Okay? The other thing we measure is, well, the other thing I measure is how close is the quotient, this mod that, to what I want to compute. So I take the quotient diagrams, modulo relations, call it A and star, and that's the other thing that I want to do. Okay? And of course it comes with shades, because each of these relations you could impose or not impose, and you do it in a manner that corresponding to the that corresponds to what we've done to the knots themselves. Okay? And again also you can take the skeleton to be either a long line as drawn here or close the line to the circle. Okay. Here are the numbers. Again. Now, before going on and telling you how these numbers were computed, I want to make a few comments about them. So, first of all, each color, you know, I have to choose the colors in PostScript, and each color has a fancy name, so I think this is peach color. So, the peach colored series of numbers, I guess, these two are what is ordinarily called virtual knots. So when Luke Kaufman, I should have mentioned Luke Kaufman before, but when Luke Kaufman came up with the notion of virtual knots, that's what he meant. Okay? I actually think it's the wrong notion of virtual knots. But still, the conjecture appears true, or is true up to degree 5, even for standard virtual knots. Okay. The purple color is what I think is the most interesting class of virtual knots. Okay? So, again, this is the class where you look at long skeleton. In fact, this is almost equally as interesting. So, long or round is not a big difference. You do not mod out by R1, and you mod out only by braid like bimaster moves, not by the cyclic bimaster moves. Why is this, to my opinion, the most interesting class? Because when you look at these relations and exclude the cyclic one, the quotient space is isomorphic to a certain space of trivalent diagrams, much like the space that we discussed yesterday, but with a slightly different twist. So that's the bracketized space for virtual knots, and it's a space in which, in addition to the vertices that were allowed before, so it's a space in which you look at diagrams that have a skeleton and on top of it some trivalent nonsense. But now there are two types of trivalent vertices that are allowed. There is the two in, one out type like before, but also a one in, two out. And then you look at this space and you mod it out by some other collection of SPU-like relations and RHX-like relations. So again, it looks like the algebras. But if you look at it more carefully, the one in, two out vertex corresponds to a co-bracket, to a Cauchy bracket. So the whole space appears to be dual. So if you look at the dual of this space, it appears to be dual to, or let's say it's more different, that's more precisely, this space somehow pairs with Lie by algebras. Lie by algebras are vector spaces that have on them both a bracket, which satisfies Jacobi, and a co-bracket, which satisfies co-Jacobi. Okay? And there is also some relationship between the two. They have to be compatible in a certain way, and this compatibility is also built in here. Okay? So, given a Lie by algebra, you can find the linear function along this space. And then my student Louis Leond wrote in a separate sitting, so this is not the same programs, wrote programs to compute all the elements of the dual of An that you get from Lie by algebras. This can be done only in the purple case. Okay, only in the purple case you have this dual, this pairing. Because the pairing doesn't satisfy the relations, the Roman 12 relation. in the right master one relation. So only in this case you have the pairing. And Lewis computed the dimension of the part of the dual that comes from Levi algebras and found it to be 2727, so far a perfect match, and then at least 128. The reason I say at least 128 is because there are Levi algebras that we haven't implemented. Okay? So this, like, if you, there is somewhere a list of Levi algebras, and we've taken some of the lists and implemented, but the rest is unknown. Okay? So it could still be that the 128 will grow to be 139, that's if you want another conjecture.
Okay? You take kind of all possible algebras, Levi algebras?
Yes.
Right.
Each one leads to a linear function out.
You try to detect as many
yes.
different elements in the vector space diagram.
Yes.
And you
yes.
see that they are testing these functions to get at least 128.
Yes. Okay. So there are two morals. First of all, this space really is close to the Levi algebras. And second, there might be a difference. And if there is a difference, then any theorem that you will be prove about this case is actually stronger than the corresponding theorem on quantum groups that the projectivization machine might be. But anyway, just to sort of the conference I was going that I didn't go to, the one in Munich, was in honor of Pierre Vogel's 65th birthday, and one thing that Pierre Vogel is famous for is there was a similar conjecture in the U case, and Pierre disproved it. So that's a question for Pierre, if you wish. How do you complete this, or what are you doing in this case? You know, again, if you now go to yellow, you found that this sequence seems familiar. Here it is. Yes, we noticed. And Karine is on her way to proving basically everything there is to ask about this sequence. So this is perhaps the only box that we have good control over. Okay?
Both diagrams will continue the same way as...
Yes. So this is, sorry, so did I say at some point that we don't understand any of the conjectures? I think if I did say that, it's a lie. Because I think this one is nearly under control. Probably it's a matter of writing.
There's one here, half here with 17 conjectures.
Yes. Okay. You know, there is another one that seems to be under control because I could compute it more and it corresponds to some known sequence, but let's skip it. You could ask, what about W? W I didn't even mention. W is also a quotient of V, and it's not one of the 18, because it's totally under control, and I explained that already, or mostly under control, and I explained that already. And then you can ask, what about braids? Whenever there are knots, there is a parallel question about braids, and the answer for braids is, I don't know. The techniques could compute it, we didn't write the programs. Actually, I'm free tomorrow. If there is somebody here ready to write a program with me, other than Karine, because I want something, so Karine and I can do it in Toronto, then I'd be delighted to cooperate. It's really a few hours away, but we haven't done it. Okay. How much time do I have? So, I mean, I started 49 minutes ago, but how much do I have?
Well, 10, I would say.
10?
It's 5 more, I suppose we can manage.
Okay, no, I'm thinking whether I should be, you know what, let me try to describe the technique. How was it computed? Okay? So the point is that virtual basically will change basis. Instead of writing virtual knots as the circuit algebra generated by crossings, when, you know, I've defined I've defined this to be over minus virtual. But equally well, I could have written this as an ordinary is equal to a semi-virtual plus a virtual. So, what? Did I mess up the signs?
No.
I messed up the crossing? What did I mess up? I don't think I messed up anything. Oh. Yes, I did mess up something. Okay. I could have equally written this. So, in other words, I could have simply changed basis. And instead of using these as the generators, I could have used these as the generators. Somewhere here, we're using the fact that virtuals are neutral. And I would not, but, and that's the thing that fails in ordinary knots. But anyway, in V knots you can do it. And then, of course, if you just, so then virtual knots become the circuit algebra generated by these symbols modulo a new collection of relations. What is the new collection of relations? These are the relations you get by starting from the ordinary Rademeister moves. So, say, Rademeister 3. Let's write Rademeister 3. Here is one side of Rademeister 3. And here is the other side of Rademeister 3. And then you just make this substitution into the relation. So you replace every crossing that appears here by a semi-virtual plus a virtual. So this becomes a sum of two things. This becomes a sum of two things. This becomes a sum of two things. And overall, this whole thing becomes eight terms. Likewise, these are not the eight that are written over there. Likewise, this side becomes eight terms. Four from here cancel from four from here completely trivially. And what remains are four on the left, these four to be precise, and four on the right, which do not cancel. So that's the new relation that replaces Rademeister 3. Okay? And I think I want to skip the next tiny bit, but just say what the result is.
Is it over? What these there are virtual ones or are...
Oh. Oops, you're right, sorry. All of these should have been virtual. This should have been, all the crossings that are not circled should be virtual. I wish I had made a list of the typos in this handout because I should fix it.
We remove your crossing, you can just
watch it. Yeah, but that's boring.
Well, you're students.
Okay. Anyway, without going into details, when you look into the associated graded, you find that in each of these relations, from each such relation, you can get a relation in the associated graded by only looking at the bottom of the relation. So this relation has terms of degree 3, so 3 here, and then, so this is degree 3, and these 3 are of degree 2. And then this is of degree 3, and these 3 are of degree 2. And it turns out that the bottom of the relation, so only the terms of degree 2, become relations in the associated gradient, but you lose the promise that these are all the relations. Okay? So all the relations that are written here, so these relations here are simply the buttons of these relations. So again, translate this language to the arrow language, and the 8-term relation, its button is dropping these two, so you have 6 terms and these are these 6. Okay? But again, you lose the promise that this is all. Now, just in case, you know, it's conceivable that I'm an idiot and it's not conceivable. But anyway, it's proven, but that's a different issue. It's possible you might think that this procedure of finding the bounds of relations is a part of a theorem. That the reason is that I'm simply missing a theorem, trivial tautological theorem about associated graded spaces, that would say that these buttons really are everything. Now, just in case you thought so, here is the warning to tell you that you're wrong. So in fact, take the two Rademeister moves together, okay? I could have written them in this order. I could have written them the way I wrote upstairs, that R2B is that this is equal to that, and R2C is that this is equal to that. Or I could have written them just permuting the first two terms. Okay? Now, if you look at the buttons of this relation when they're translated using the procedure of above, you get the relation. So if you look at them in this order, and you look at the bottom of this relation and the bottom of this relation, you get from here, you get that plus is the negative of minus, and from here you get the Roman 12. If you write them in this order, then the bottom of this relation is that plus is equal to the negative of minus, and the bottom of this relation is that plus is equal to the negative of minus. So you would have missed the Roman 12 relation. Okay? So this procedure of taking the bottom is not even well defined. It's well defined once I've chosen a way of writing the relations, and I was clever in the way I wrote the relations, but it's not really clever, it's more trial and error and long time. So what I wrote was right, but it's subtly right. It's not obviously right. Okay. Okay. So, of course, the true count is not 18. I mean, what I really expect is that there will be a bang somewhere. You prove one of the things, and unfortunately, the one that we probably know how to prove is not strong enough. So you'll have a bang in the most interesting place, and then you'll also find 5 compatible transfer principles, but I don't know what they are. Okay, so I tell you that if you've proven this conjecture, you've also proven the one to its left, the one to its right, the one above, and basically all of this. But I have no idea how to do that. And to be more explicit, I really expect that the bang will be a big bang. And big bang in this case would be a proof by finding a homomorphic expansion with values that takes its domain to be virtual knots within the particular square that I've highlighted, and with values in the corresponding arrow diagram.